supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Victims of the 2013 Center City building collapse are receiving a record settlement. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
$227 million will go to those who were injured and the families of those who died in the building collapse at 22nd and Market Streets. It happened when a building under demolition fell onto the Salvation Army thrift store next door, killing 7 and injuring 13. The settlement comes a week after a Philadelphia jury found the building owner, members of his demolition crew, as well as the Salvation Army liable for the accident. Attorney Jeffrey Goodman says the ruling and the settlement send a clear warning to businesses everywhere.
And what that warning is that if you don't place safety as priority number one, you'll be held accountable.
Attorneys say the $227 million settlement is the largest personal injury award in Pennsylvania history, but that's little consolation to the families of the victims, like Rosalind Conte, who was killed when the Salvation Army store came down on top of her. Francis Sanko is her son.
We're going back home today, and she's still not there, you know, and other people lost loved ones, too, on that fateful day. So it's a kind of a bittersweet memory, but at the same time, we're glad. At least laws have been set in place to help prevent other lives from fallen victims.
In the past 3.5 years, there's been a civil trial, there's been a criminal trial, and two contractors involved in the collapse have gone to prison. Attorney Robert Mongaluzzi, who represents some of the victims, says it has been an emotional journey.
People think that as trial lawyers that you're removed from all this, but it takes a little piece of you every tragedy takes a little piece of you away.
An independent arbitrator is expected to divvy up the awards this spring. For WHYY, I'm Joe Hernandez.
A contentious abortion bill has passed the Pennsylvania Senate following hours of passionate debate. It would make abortions illegal after 20 weeks of gestation, narrowing the threshold from the current 24 weeks. It would also significantly limit the use of a common abortion procedure. WHYY's Katie Meyer reports medical experts have raised serious concerns about the bill.
GOP Senator Michelle Brooks of Crawford County is the bill's chief sponsor. She centered her testimony around graphic descriptions of a procedure she called dismemberment abortion.
A live 6-month-old fetus can be ripped apart and left to bleed to death.
But representatives from nonpartisan medical organizations like the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists say those claims are inflammatory and not based in fact. Philadelphia OBGYN Thomas Dardarian says the procedure is medically known as D&E, and it's unquestionably the safest abortion method.
The term dismemberment, it is not a medical term. They're terms to rile up the public.
The tensest moment of the floor debate came when Senator Lisa Baker, a Luzerne County Republican, broke party lines to oppose the bill, citing her own late-term pregnancy complications.
This bill could compound the suffering of individuals who are going through the worst moments a mother can experience.
The bill sponsors have declined to hold public hearings. Wolf has said he would veto the bill. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
There's a new candidate in the race for Philadelphia District Attorney. WHYY's Dave Davies has that story.
Lawrence Krasner doesn't fit the typical profile for an aspiring DA. They're often former prosecutors pushing a law and order message. Krasner has a background as a public defender and is known for representing activists arrested in protests. His campaign statement refers to the need for a truly progressive district attorney in an era of authoritarian government. Krasner is the fifth announced candidate to oppose incumbent Seth Williams in the May Democratic primary. Williams was recently fined a record-setting $62,000 by the City Ethics Board for failing to disclose gifts he'd received on annual financial reports. Beth Grossman is the lone Republican running in this heavily Democratic city. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Just about everyone remembers the tremendous amount of damage caused by Superstorm Sandy. NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller sat down with the University of Pennsylvania doctoral candidate who is studying an unconventional way to combat beach erosion.
The term invasive species often carries a negative connotation, but not so regarding a plant along the Jersey Shore that apparently aids in coastal stability. It's the work of University of Pennsylvania doctoral candidate Bianca Charbonneau, who joins me now. Bianca, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave. I'm really excited to be here.
You were motivated by the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy. What was the nature of the project?
Yes, this was research that I did for my master's at Villanova University. I was trying to understand some aspect of the erosion that was incurred from Superstorm Sandy that would help us be better prepared for the next inevitable storm.
So what is the role of plants in making dunes hardier?
So plants, I like to think of them as the powerhouse of dunes. Their roots actually provide a structure and stability to the dune, acting almost like a net to hold the sand in place so that when you then have a wave crashing into the dune, those roots are binding the sand and helping it have some structure so that when you have a wave hit the dune, you don't lose entire chunks of dune, kind of like an avalanche where you would have a whole chunk of material scarp away, but instead you have thin layers that are sloughed away with each wave. And so the amount of erosion you have is reduced in that manner. And then the leaves actually allow the dune to grow in time. The above ground leaves offer substrate whereby the windblown sand actually hits the leaves and drops to the plants, and then the plants grow up through that sand over time. And so the plants grow, and as it does, so does the dune.
What's the specific name of this plant that's doing a great job both in terms of root structure and leaves?
Well, they're all doing a great job. The dunes are an extremely stressful habitat, so worldwide there's only a handful that can actually stabilize this first line of dunes, which is the first line of defense during storms. And so for the invasive, its common name is Asiatic sandsedge, and it's found at extremely high densities, and it seems to invest a lot more in its roots compared to its shoots, its leaves. Compared to its native counterpart, which in New Jersey is American beach grass, Ammophila brevoligulata, which is the poster child, really, for dune replenishment. And if anyone's ever done any sort of planting effort, that's what you would have planted.
But is the poster child at risk due to this invasive species?
Yes. So the invasive arrived, actually, in America at my field site, Island Beach State Park, New Jersey, in 1929.
Was it called an invasive species then?
Back then, I don't believe that we had that term. And it was actually commercially available for a number of years until the 80s, 90s, when people started to recognize that it maybe had these unwanted characteristics of outcompeting other species and really creating dense matting. And so the public opinion towards this species, which was originally touted as a dune stabilizer and planted, started to shift until the late 90s. It was put on New Jersey's most unwanted species list. It's now considered an invasive. And since 2005, we've actually scientifically documented its effects that show it really isn't invasive. It reduces native diversity and density.
So, though, to what extent can you measure how well it does in preserving a dune versus the, again, more popular species?
So what we did for that was we actually looked at erosion as a function of what species was stabilizing the dune from Superstorm Sandy. And usually when you look at erosion, you're talking about volumetric loss, the actual amount of dune or beach that you lost and that was eroded and taken offshore during a storm. To have that, though, you need to have really expensive LIDAR data. It's elevation data that's flown from satellites or from planes. But we had aerials at the time, and being able to discern where the crest was pre-Sandy and then post-Sandy, and knowing where the different species were, we were able to compare erosion as east to west loss of dune, which, thinking of it like a mapper looking down at a map. So how much did you lose from one spot to the next, and how did that vary by the species that was actually there stabilizing the dune and holding it together?
In qualitative terms, were the results dramatic, minuscule, in between?
I think they were pretty dramatic. They were a lot larger than I suspected. Walking along the dunes myself, I had my suspicions, my hypotheses of what we might see. But for the invasive versus the native, we found approximately 3.6 to 2.5 more meters of erosion for our native compared to our invasive, which almost the length of a room. So that's a significant chunk of dune. And when you think of how much time it takes to build a dune up, that's a significant effect.
Bianca, thanks for joining us to shed light on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
University of Pennsylvania doctoral candidate Bianca Charbonneau, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
That was NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller. Many people can't receive a degree because they don't have money. They can, in turn, find a job because they don't have a degree. One organization headquartered in Philadelphia is offering young people a way to break into an in-demand field without high tuition. Rob Savatsky reports on IT Works.
call it IT Works, because it's basically teaching young people IT skills, particularly infrastructure-based skills. So preparing them for jobs on a help desk or desk-side technicians or in a network operations center.
Patrick Callahan is the executive director for Tech Impact that offers tech support to local nonprofits. In 2011, it expanded to offer technology-focused workforce development to people 18 to 26 who are out of school, out of work, and without a college degree. IT Work started in Philadelphia and was introduced in Delaware soon after. And in 2016, the program was launched in Las Vegas. Callahan says IT Works is different from other programs aimed at adult learners because it is completely free for students.
We're focused on social return. So for us, what's important is training people and putting them to work. So everything we do is centered around that.
The program runs on philanthropic support. Grace Harpole oversees classroom instructors at IT Works and helps place graduates in jobs. She works with area technology leaders to identify the skills they look for in an entry-level candidate. She says in addition to technical training, students learn valuable soft skills that make them stronger job candidates.
We bring in volunteers who are, again, leaders in technology in the area to talk to the students about communication and conflict management on the job, help with their resumes, conduct mock interviews. And I think these skills are really essential for the students, not only in landing their entry-level position, but as they move up in their career.
Andre Chambers earned some credits at Wesley College in Dover, but had to drop out because he couldn't afford the tuition. The 24-year-old enrolled into the IT Works program as an alternative.
After finishing the program and after meeting everyone that I met and after, you know, getting my job here, I'm a lot more confident.
He says he learned practical skills that would help him get a job a lot quicker than he would simply by going to college. Since the IT Works program is free, he's not saddled with student loans. Before starting with IT Works, Chambers had limited technical skills. Now he works as an IT service desk analyst at WSFS Bank in Wilmington, where he was recently named Employee of the Month.
I'm fixing computers, I'm working in Active Directory, I'm restarting SQL servers, I'm configuring databases. So it's definitely a 180-degree difference from before I started to now.
After years of working in the service industry, Chambers says he never imagined he would have a tech career. His friends quickly wanted to know if they could follow in his footsteps.
Some have, you know, the jobs I had before this, so like the manual jobs, the construction jobs. Actually, four of my friends just graduated the program after me.
The instructor for the Delaware class of IT Works is Oliver Withstandley. A lot of his students live in poverty, and he says sometimes need help outside of formal instruction.
Are their social-emotional needs really sort of being met too, right? You know, are they okay out of the classroom? Because if they're not okay outside of the classroom, they're not going to perform well in the classroom.
IT Works partners with local community groups to identify students, but most new students are referred to it by recent graduates. Potential students undergo a rigorous interview process to help determine if they have what it takes to stick with it and finish the program.
It's not always super fun, right? You know, like learning, I like learning binary, but not everybody likes binary. And so it could be really boring for someone. How do they get through that task and not want to quit?
The 16-week spring semester for IT Works begins next month, and there's another one starting in the fall. For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
A tribute to a 1920s literary magazine produced by black writers in Philadelphia is taking part at the Rosenbach Library tomorrow evening. Among the gathering of poets and musicians is the city's poet laureate, Yolanda Wisher. She stopped by WHYY with guitarist Jim Dragoni and spoke with Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller.
Yolanda, this is an homage to a literary magazine called Black Opals with very Philadelphia roots. Describe that publication and that time for us.
Yeah, so a lot of folks are familiar with the Harlem Renaissance era and how important that was to New York City. And I was doing some research a couple years ago trying to find what was going on in Philly around the time. And around 1927, 28, a group of black intellectuals, writers, creative artists got together and created a literary publication that they self-published. And they made about 200 copies. And it was really to express their voice in this new era of racial identity and pride. And some of the folks that are kind of really connected to Philadelphia history, like Jesse Redmond Fawcett, were part of this crew of young writers who created this publication.
So it's seeded in Harlem and then sprung up in various other cities, Philadelphia included.
Right. Exactly. It was mostly a product of the Great Migration out of the South. And so a lot of black folks landed in New York and Harlem. A lot of folks landed in Philly. But Harlem gets all the credit for the kind of creative renaissance because folks like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston were up there. And so they're kind of celebrity poets of the era. So I was really excited to find that this kind of activity was happening around Philly at the same time. And some of those poets were kind of going back and forth between New York and Philly, like Louis Alexander, who appears in some of those Harlem Renaissance publications.
And so describe tomorrow night, Blues for Black Opals, Yolanda Wisher, Dick Laurie and company.
Yes, so the company is just an amazing group of poets that I've known for a while in Philadelphia, Tripita Mason, Quincy Scott Jones, and Aren Matthews. So these are some, I wouldn't call them emerging, but established and up-and-coming writers in Philadelphia who are going to be sharing their own work as well as some of the poems of the Black Opals writers. And those performances and readings will be interspersed with some musical performances by me and my band.
Philadelphia poet laureate, 2015 Pew Fellow, and apparently the inaugural Montgomery County, Pennsylvania Poet Laureate. I'd love to hear one of your compositions.
Sure. We're going to do a poem called With a Line from the Weather Girls after Apollinaire and O'Hara. It's raining. Moonflowers, or bougainvillea, or Grace Kelly's. Auricular blooms in the dark leaves, wearing white gloves. Jazz-handled marshmallows melting into pocket squares. Their cardigan legs crossed, their Adirondack jaws set for takeoff. Yeah, I wrote this poem based on a photograph for a photographer's project. But I was really trying to say something about black female identity, really inspired by Frank O'Hara's poem, The Day Billy Died, which has been just one of those important, sacred poems that guides you. So trying to, you know, write something inspired by some poets who have influenced me.
Discuss some of your influences that brought you to your esteemed position in the Philadelphia poetry community now.
Well, you know, I came to Philadelphia for grad school in search of the poet Sonia Sanchez.
You found her.
I found her, and I stalked her so that she would take me on as an advisee and help me learn the craft of writing and living as a poet. So she was one of my first teachers as a grown poet. But there were folks on my mother's bookshelves, like Alice Walker was another poet who also wrote novels, and Zora Neale Hurston.
You mentioned Langston Hughes.
Yeah, Langston Hughes was an early one. Phyllis Wheatley, whose book I've actually, her first collection of poems, that first edition I've been able to hold at the Rosenbach. So yeah, I walk really strongly in a black arts literary tradition, and it's definitely influenced by blues and jazz, but also really strongly influenced by the beat poets like Ginsberg, people like O'Hara who kind of straddled those movements, poets who really regarded the art of writing poetry as not unlike musical composition.
Yolanda, Jim, I'm sure it will be a wonderful performance tomorrow evening at the Rosenbach. What will you take us home with?
We're going to leave you with a song called Mud Puddle Blues, and it's just a little ditty to somebody I love who keeps me afloat.
Yimmy ah in my basement, ocean in my pipes, no trust fund in the 215.
Philadelphia poet laureate Yolanda Wisher and guitarist Jim Dragoni. You can hear more music and more conversation at newsworks.org.
No rest in the Northwest would be drowning were it not for you. You would be drowning were it not for you.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald, sitting in for Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Drowning were it not for you.
Thank you.